Hope everybody is enjoying this liquid sunshine we're having here. It's kind of apropos because some of y'all heard, or I know some of our district folks heard me talk about the perfect storm when it comes to transportation. And no, I didn't go to meteorological school and looking to change my career. But you look at things that are going on in transportation today, and we are coming to that perfect storm. We have the sunset review here in our Texas legislature of the Texas Department of Transportation. We have the CDA panel that will be looking at our comprehensive development agreement process and how we move forward with it. But on the federal level, the storm's brewing there too. Whether it's remembering that the reauthorization of Safety Lou comes up in 2009, or the news we've been hearing about with the Highway Trust Fund, or even going a little bit further in 2010 when air quality standards have to be met in our metropolitan areas. This is all going to affect transportation, and we need to be working together to solve this issue. We put together a great panel here today to talk about the federal side of it, and there is one change to it. Mr. Jim Ray, who's the deputy counsel for DOT, is unable to be with us today, but we did get an able substitute. Billy Moore will be making a presentation on the federal program. So without any ado, we're going to start our panel this morning with Mitch Rappaport. Mitch has been a partner in Washington, D.C.'s offices of Nixon Peabody since 1995. And before joining this firm, Mitch was a partner with Mudge, Ross, Guthrie, Alexander, and Fernand. He spent his early career with the Internal Revenue Service, so don't everybody get up and run. He was only the general counsel, so of litigation and regulation division, and more recently in the Department of Treasury, the Office of Tax Policy. During his time at the Treasury, Mitch assisted in drafting the proposed private activity bond regulations, the arbitrage regulations, and the rules relating to changes of use of bond finance facilities and management contracts. Mitch has participated in a wide variety of tax-exempt financing, including numerous refunding transactions, stadium and convention center transactions, and education, multifamily housing, and solid waste disposal facilities. And he's provided advice in a number of privatization transactions. Mitch is an active member of the National Association of Bond Lawyers, served as chair of the association's General Tax Matters Committee and of its 1998 Washington Seminar, and is currently vice chair of the Tax Committee. So, Mitch.
I apologize for that long biography, and I know you're all tingling with excitement having heard it. Thank you. I guess there was a cover sheet, but that doesn't really matter. Anyway, as you can tell, I'm burdened with being a tax lawyer, and these fellows here decided that the best thing to start off with at 8:30 in the morning was arcane and technical rules about tax-exempt finance. So keep chugging the coffee, and hopefully it'll kind of all balance out. But anyway, the federal program that I'm here to talk about, because it's about all I know in my life at this point, is tax-exempt finance. And I think we don't tend to think of that as a federal program, but the federal government and Congress certainly do, because it's the federal government and the everyone's favorite Internal Revenue Code that permit state and local governments to borrow on a tax-exempt basis. And as you all know, borrowing on a tax-exempt basis is a cheaper way to finance your projects than other mechanisms that are out there. And so in the transportation area, tax-exempt finance plays an important part. And what the basic area that I want to talk about is how the tax-exempt finance interacts with bringing private parties into your a transportation project, because in effect, as I'll get into in probably way too painful detail, the rules for issuing tax-exempt bonds limit the ability to bring private participants in the transaction. Fortunately, as I'll talk about, Safety Lou has eased up on that a bit, but there are still limitations and still choices to be made in terms of financing a project and balancing the use of tax-exempt finance and the participation of private persons. And so, just as you know, real general background that you probably already know, in tax-exempt bond lingo, we divide the world up into governmental bonds and private activity bonds. Governmental bonds are a situation where you issue tax-exempt bonds to finance a project, and you have very limited private participation. I'll talk a bit more about what that means. But typically, it's a governmentally owned project, usually governmentally operated, but limited private participation. Once you get beyond that limited private participation, then the bonds are private activity bonds. And typically, private activity bonds are bonds that cannot be issued on a tax-exempt basis. Thanks to the Safety Lou provisions, certain transportation projects, despite the private involvement, still qualify for tax-exempt financing. And so those are good private activity bonds versus bad private activity bonds. But they're, you know, if you can do those bonds on a tax-exempt basis, that you still have to deal with a slew of limitations. Taxable bonds are, you know, obviously bear the higher interest cost, but don't have all these limitations that I'm going to talk about. And then private equity, even higher cost, and then to both taxable and tax-exempt, but often a part of the mix. If I can go down here, there we go. So when we talk about governmental bonds, in a way they're the best, at least from the pointy-headed place where I live, because you get tax-exempt rates and no federal volume limitations, like the $15 billion safety lieu limitation that I'll talk about. However, the problem is the ability to involve private parties is very limited. Your project, if we're talking about a toll road project, it can't be privately owned. It can't be leased to a private entity. You can't loan the bond proceeds to a private entity and say, go build the project. And even if you want to engage a private entity to manage or operate the project, there are very strict limitations on doing that. You've got things like limitations to how long you can engage a person to manage it. You can't pay that person based on a share of the profits. And you need to have the ability to kick them out at various points in time without a penalty. And so what all this leads to, in if we're talking about governmental bonds, is in one sense a distinction between design-build, which is okay, and design-build-operate, which is much tougher to do with governmental bonds. So, you know, just to, you know, round that out, the idea is governmental bonds are tax-exempt, but you very limited private participation. On the other hand, we've got private activity bonds that are permitted by Safety Lou. And this, as you probably know, is a relatively new program, only started in 2005. Actually, as I'll talk about more in a minute, no private activity bonds have been issued under this program yet, but there's $15 billion of authorization there. And this program permits private activity bonds to be issued on a tax-exempt basis for certain kinds of transportation projects that receive Title 23 federal funding. And importantly, for our purposes, any surface transportation project receiving Title 23 federal funding qualifies for this program. Again, $15 billion of authorization. Strangely, for a federal tax program, it's not the IRS. Or the states that allocate that $15 billion, it's the U.S. Department of Transportation. So the Department of Transportation basically has to work together with the IRS to make this program work. And, you know, one of the real benefits of this program is that if you qualify, if you get some of the $15 billion, there are very few limitations on private involvement in the program. So again, unlike governmental bonds, you can lease the project to a private entity. A private entity can own the project, and so on. A lot of words on this slide, but try not to get it to be too painful. But despite the ability to issue private activity bonds on a tax-exempt basis, you always need a governmental entity involved. You always need a governmental entity to issue the bonds. And so you can't just have the private entity go and issue the bonds on its own. Again, as I mentioned, with this program, you can loan the proceeds to the private entity. You can build the facility and lease it to the private entity, or the private entity can design, build, and lease it, and so on. Often these are structured on sort of a project finance basis where there's no recourse in any of these transactions to the governmental issuer. But then often they're, kind of project financing structure where the bondholders can look to the revenues from the project and not much else. The governmental entity, the state or local government, can impose other limitations if it wants. It can charge fees and the like to the borrower of the proceeds, although there are limitations on that. And again, through these rules, unlike the governmental bond rules, you can have a design, build, operate scenario with no limitations on how the operator, the private entity, gets compensated for its services. Again, lots of rules here, and it's enough to make a living on, but you don't want to get too deep into it at 8:30 in the morning. So just real briefly, when you do one of these private activity bonds, nearly all the proceeds have to go into what are called qualifying costs. You can't, as an example, you can't fund a lot of working capital. It's got a 95% of the proceeds have to go into real hard costs and design costs. What, on the tax side, similar to the accounting side, capital expenditures is the notion. As I'll talk about, there are lots of, over the years, Congress has added lots of limitations to the private activity bond rules. And because these transportation bonds are private activity bonds, they're subject to these rules as well, rules that limit, and I'll talk about these a bit more in a minute, rules that limit how much land you can buy with private activity proceeds, whether you can buy existing property and the like. You also, for those of you thinking about it, you can't use private activity bonds to finance things like massage parlors and liquor stores. You've got to spend, it's important that the project proceed relatively quickly. You've got to spend the proceeds within 5 years, or at that point the law requires that the unused money be used to make the bonds go away. I know you're probably thinking, if I issue private activity bonds, am I allowed to refinance them? I know that was a question on a lot of your minds. And there is a distinction between governmental bonds and private activity bonds. A lot more flexibility to, rates go down, you want to refinance, just like refinancing your mortgage. There's a lot more flexibility to refinance governmental bonds than there is private activity bonds. But for private activity bonds, you can refinance them, but you can't, you can't extend their average life and you can't increase the amount you borrowed. So, for instance, if the federal DOT gave you $1 billion and you issued $1 billion of bonds, you can't, when you refinance them, increase the amount you borrowed, for obvious reasons. How do I apply for these bonds, you ask? Fortunately, the Department of Transportation has come out with some guidelines on how to do that, and they said they have not put out any sort of a formal application, but they said that the following information will facilitate their consideration. And so naturally, anyone who's thinking about applying for some of the allocation follows the DOT guidelines very closely. Again, this is one of those areas where the IRS and the DOT coordinate. The Department of it's just a real brief listing here of the categories and kinds of information that they're looking for. A lot more detail in the notice they put out. This is the DOT. Whoops. DOT put out that notice on January 5th, 2006. And as I mentioned, IRS and DOT have to coordinate pretty closely. So in a bit of phenomenal intergovernmental cooperation, DOT issued that notice on January 5th. And 4 months later, simultaneously, the IRS issued its mirror notice saying that they were going to listen to what DOT says. But, you know, a lot of this is not surprising, the kind of information you have to put in there, the amount of allocation you're requesting, when you're going to issue the bonds, drafts of your project, you know, who's on your project development team, what the financing looks like, what the project looks like, what the schedule is, the financial structure, an indication of, you know, of how ready the project is to go, because as you can imagine, DOT doesn't want to give you an allocation if your project isn't real, if it's not going to get financed, you know, reasonably quickly. You've got to sign, you've got to make certain declarations, and so on. And, you know, it adds up to a pretty substantial package that you have to submit to DOT. But presumably, you know, a lot of it you know, in one way or another, done already if your project is at the point where you're ready to request, you know, some of the allocation for financing. So they, you know, after you put that all that information together, their notice tells you there are no specific standards that they apply, and so it's a little bit mysterious as to what criteria they look to. But they are one of the things that once they make the allocation, they're very concerned that the cap not get wasted, that the cap they've given you not get wasted. And so they reserve the right to take the allocation back if you haven't issued the bonds by when you said you would. You know, presumably you can, you know, work with, if there are delays for good reasons, you can work out, you know, presumably you can work with them to get the timeline extended. I don't think they want to pull the rug out from anyone. You know, but I'm sure it's got to be something better than explaining to them that your dog ate your homework. In terms of IRS coordination here, what the DOT is saying by giving you an allocation is two things. One, the obvious, they've given you an allocation. The second is that it's the kind of project that Safety Lou had in mind. Again, you know, a surface transportation project. So once you get that allocation, the IRS says they're not going to question the, let me back up. The IRS always has the ability to challenge qualification of a bond as a tax-exempt bond. They have an audit program. They go out and audit issuers for various things. And in theory, they could, once one of these bonds get issued, go and try to argue that it's not really a good Title 23 project. But what the IRS has said is once DOT has signed off on it in that respect, they're not going to challenge it. However, that doesn't mean they're not going to challenge the other, you know, 100 requirements that you have to meet to have a good private activity bond, in particular things like spending the proceeds on capital expenditures. The Billy's favorite real technical stuff are some of the problems with the Safety Lou private activity bond problems. And, you know, what happened with this program, as I mentioned, is it got enacted in 2005 at a point when we had, you know, 25 plus years of history of Congress tinkering with the private activity bond rules. They would, you know, private activity bonds would get issued for something, Congress would decide they didn't like that, and so they'd put a rule in. So that's why you can't finance massage parlors, because somebody did, and Congress decided that wasn't a good use of this federal subsidy. But the aside from the easy ones to see like that, there are rules that say you can't use more than 25% of the proceeds of bonds to acquire private activity bonds to acquire land. You can't use private activity bond proceeds to acquire existing property. And the reasons for those rules made sense in other contexts where, for example, you're permitted to issue small amounts of private activity bonds for almost anything. But what Congress said is they didn't want private activity bonds issued for me to sell somebody else an existing factory. They wanted it for new capital. And so they said, okay, therefore, no use of private activity bond proceeds for existing property. But now that rule applies to the Safety Lou transportation bonds. And what do you do if you're TxDOT and you've got a project that's partially built, or it's an existing highway that you want to sell to a private entity for them to expand it, to improve it, and so on? You run into this limitation on using proceeds to acquire existing property. Similar thinking with acquiring land. Congress didn't want private activity bonds used just so Joe could sell Bob, you know, 100 acres. And so there are limitations on land. But then when this rule applies in this context, what happens when you want to use private activity bond proceeds to acquire land for the road, rights away, and so on? You run into this problem. Couple other similar kinds of problems like that, and I don't have, one answer is that frequently in these programs, the private activity bond proceeds are only part of the dollars that are being brought to the table, and so maybe use the equity, the taxable financing, other monies for these problematic costs. The other answer is that we've been working with TxDOT to try to explain these problems to the feds and congressional types, because this program, was enacted pretty quickly. I think as people get into finance using this tool, we're seeing technical problems like these that hadn't been thought of when the legislation was very quickly enacted. In terms of examples of projects, I think before getting into the examples, so as I mentioned, none of these bonds have been issued yet. The Federal Department of Transportation has given what they call provisional approval to three different projects. The Miami Tunnel project, which got two provisional allocations, because what they helpfully have done is, as municipal entities go out and to take proposals from developers, DOT has allowed those developers that are submitting proposals to the municipality to go to DOT and say, if we get this project, will you allocate private activity bonds to it? And so in the Miami Tunnel project, two of the applicants did that. One went in for $1.4 billion, one went in for $900 billion. DOT said to each of them, if you win, if you build it, we will give it to you. But so it's sort of a provisional allocation, which, as you can imagine, very helpful in the development and the proposal process for this. Same kind of provisional allocation for a bridge project in Missouri that got $600 million. And then here in Texas, State Highway 121 got $1.8 billion and change of an allocation. In terms of other projects, I just listed a few, some of which I just talked about. But there are lots and lots, I think, of potential projects out there. The best projects for this tool seem to be, and if you talk to the investment bankers, the ones that have an availability payment structure where the municipality is going to make specified payments for availability. That gives the greater kind of certainty that the bankers seem to be able to take and borrow against and leverage. And so with that, I will stop babbling and turn you over to somebody else. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch. And I guess I have to apologize for stumbling through your introduction to you and the audience, but I just realized I'm wearing my glasses, and a lot of y'all have been asking me, Steve, I've never seen you wear glasses before, but I need them for distance. And I went into the doctor, and he said, you're experiencing TMB syndrome. I said, Doc, what's that? He says, too many birthdays. And so I can't read what's down here, so I'm going to remember to take my glasses off this time. So, our next speaker is Billy Moore, and Billy brings decades of Capitol Hill experience. He's a veteran of more than 50 election campaigns and worked 26 years in the U.S. Congress. For the past 6 years, Billy's managed a coalition of finance corporation and real estate associations and directed the U.S. government sales strategy for a worldwide provider of information technology services. He also directed strategic advocacy for clients in transportation, health, technology, elections, real estate, and scientific research. Billy's work on electoral campaigns dates to 1969 and includes races for local, state, and congressional and presidential offices. He served U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson from Texas for 10 years and was chief of staff to U.S. Representative Jim Chapman of Texas and David Price of North Carolina. He also served on the staffs of the House Appropriations and Budget Committees. Billy is a guest lecturer at the United States War College, the Johns Hopkins University Center for Strategic and International Studies, and the Industrial College of the Armed Forces. He also served as chairman of the Duke University School of Law Center, for the study of Congress. And unfortunately, Billy attended the University of Texas at Austin. So, Billy, welcome.
Thanks, Tim. What I want to talk about most this morning is the surface transportation bill. Safety Lou, I think everybody knows by now, is going to expire in September of 2009. I want to put it in a broader context, though, and then focus a little more on where we're going to go over the next couple of years. The most broad context in terms of the political situation is we will have the first presidential election since 1952 next year that does not involve an incumbent president or vice president. It's a more wide-open race than we've seen in almost 50 years. And if prior indications that money talks it is likely to hold true in this campaign, you've got probably four front runners: Mrs. Clinton, Senator Obama, Mayor Giuliani, and Governor Romney. If organization counts, you add two more to that, Edwards and Richardson. And there are a couple of races that are curveballs right now, Senator McCain and Governor Richardson, or Fred Thompson. Within that context, the only candidate to win a third term in the presidency, where a president who served two terms is followed by a president of the same party in the post-war era, was George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush. The odds, I think, at most commentators, and I depend on Charlie Cook for this, put the odds on for a Democratic president, but I'm not sure how much that matters. Because no matter who wins in 2008, the next president is likely to be able to emphasize three major priorities and be successful. And whoever the next president is, the first priority is going to be dealing with the situation in Iraq, however it's left to that president. That's going to be the first mission of whoever next wins the White House. And in that same context, they're going to have another priority of rebuilding international relationships that have been frayed by the war in Iraq, and that will be both in terms of our military relationships and our trade relationships, and those are going to be the first two priorities. The third priority is likely to be the situation with the tax code, which Mitch knows so much about, because in 2010, there's a meltdown in the tax code about to occur, both with the inheritance tax, all the reductions in the inheritance tax expire in 2010, as do the rate reductions that were enacted in the first year of George W. Bush's presidency. The capital gains goes up to 20%. The alternative minimum tax, which we've been patching, Congress has been patching every year. The most likely first priority for any president elected in 2008, in 2009, will be fixing a tax system that's going broke. In that sense, transportation is unlikely to be a first priority or in that upper tier of priorities, no matter who the president is. It will be a top priority for whoever is the Secretary of Transportation. It will be a top priority for the committee leadership in the House and Senate, and it will absolutely be a first priority for the Texas Department of Transportation. In the Congress, in the 2008 election, most of the commentators believe that there is likely to be an expansion of a couple of seats of the Democratic majority in the Senate, which is now 51-49 Democratic. And in the House, where the division is 231 to 201 for the Democrats have about 36 seats that are vulnerable. The Republicans about 26 seats. And if you just went by that, you would assume that the Democratic majority might decline a bit. That will depend on what happens in the presidential race. And more important than anything else, what's happening in Iraq when it comes time November next year. With the Highway Trust Fund being in the condition that it's in, we've got Mr. Shenandoah's commission working on recommendations to try and present a unified position for Congress to deal with it. In the committee leadership that we have today, if that carries over to the 111th Congress in 2009, we're going to have some committee leaders who believe that the first direction we should take transportation policy, highway finance, should be an increase in the gasoline tax. And there are others who believe that that's not the right direction to go, that we should go in a direction that includes some of the innovations in highway finance that Mitch was talking about and that you heard about yesterday. And some, especially in the House, are hostile to those ideas. And I think one of the things we heard yesterday, that the strategy, at least for the moment, is to get worse slowly. That there is unlikely to be a prospect for improving the situation for highway finance anytime in the immediate future. But if you listen to JC yesterday, when he talked about the OMB mid-session review, the Office of Management and Budget, their forecast for the balance of the year and looking forward a revision to their budget projections, in the last week, they predicted that the Highway Trust Fund will be insolvent by $4 billion in 2009. That's not getting worse slowly. That's an acceleration of highway finance getting worse. The obligation limitation that would result in is likely to be about $16.5 billion. That's a 38% reduction from what's forecast for 2009, which would be an obligation of about $43 billion. We've got two committees in Congress, the two appropriations committees, have recommended transportation appropriations bills. Both of them recommend a highway program of $40.2 billion for fiscal 2008, beginning October 1st. And at least for the time being, that's going to be the high water mark. It includes some rescissions. We've been going through rescissions in this process for the last several years, where in order to make room for other spending, the appropriators have been taking amounts out of the highway program. That's continuing. It's unlikely to continue in the future, especially if we're looking at reductions of the magnitude that are being forecast by the White House right now in the highway fund. And the AGC's analysis of the White House projection means we could lose in Texas, if we lose that much in 2009, if the fund is that insolvent, over $1 billion. And the 2010 shortfall is going to grow bigger without action, about $9 billion, and probably around $15 billion in 2011. Congress is capable of dealing with that problem, of doing something about the shortfall. And, in fact, when the appropriators in the Senate were debating the bill they reported this week, Patty Murray, a senator from Washington who's chairman of the Transportation Subcommittee, said that it would be a very good thing if the Senate Finance Committee, the Tax Committee, took care of this problem before they had to write a bill next year. So the Spending Committee has decided it's not their problem, at least from the Authorizing Committee, the Transportation Committee in the House, the Public Works in the Senate. Transportation in the House is busy dealing with an aviation bill, which is it in some trouble. Public Works is waiting to see what happens. The likelihood of Congress dealing with it in the short term, right now, to do something about the shortfall that's forecast to begin next year. I don't know if you've been paying attention to the Senate, but the Senate can't agree that Saturday's a weekend right now. We've had over 6 weeks of debate in the Senate on the war in Iraq and resolved nothing. We had 4 weeks of debate in the Senate on an immigration bill that's now dead. And day before yesterday, the defense authorization bill was pulled from the floor after about 10 days of debate. And they're going to start turning to appropriations bills next week. Depending on the Senate Finance Committee and then the full Senate to do something in the very short term to deal with the Highway Trust Fund shortfall is unlikely. Um, 2008 is going to be an election year, and if what the other senators are looking for the Senate Finance Committee to cure is a tax bill to shore up the trust fund, tax bills in election years in Washington have a very poor record. I think in the context both of their own reelection and in terms of what is going to happen in the presidential campaign, the likelihood of a tax bill to raise gasoline taxes in 2008 is pretty low. So that means, Steve, that Washington is going to hand you the bag, and you, for 2008 and 2009. There may be some nibbling around the edges, some closing of the gap, but the elimination of the shortfall is a less than 5% likelihood. And it's in that context that Mr. Schindendorf's commission is being looked to provide some of the guidance, the boundaries of a solution that will result in a consensus. There's a pretty big fight going on, and there are advocates not just on the Hill but in various groups around the Capitol for a solution that involves a tax increase. AASHTO is promoting, although their proposal was prior to this mid-session review, a 3-cent increase now, a 10-cent increase later in the gasoline tax. And in light of these new results, that is likely not enough. I think Jack knows more than I on whether it would be. Others are promoting innovative finance tools like the private activity bonds that Mitch was talking about, more freedom for states in terms of tolling, in terms of bonds, in terms of public-private partnerships, fewer restrictions on how to allocate funds. But that is not likely to come to the floor of Congress in either House, probably until 2009. In 2009, the Secretary of Transportation, whoever that may be, will play a more prominent role in shaping whatever debate we're going to have. In the House, if Mr. Oberstar is still the chairman, we are likely to have a bill that's based on tax increases. If Mrs. Boxer is still chairman in the Senate, I think that's an unknown. She's not really signaled one way or the other, which is her preference. But in that sense, Senator Baucus, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee and formerly chaired Public Works, and Senator Inhofe, who is the ranking Republican, have been helpful to us in our efforts in the past on more innovative financial tools. And how that will be resolved in the Senate, I think, is unknown right now. And that leads perhaps to three, maybe four scenarios of where we will be beginning in the next presidency and the next Congress. One of those scenarios would be till the last dog dies, and that would be congressional gridlock on the issue of taxes and other financial tools for surface transportation, in which case they would probably kick on down the road for short periods of time, as we did before Safety Lou was enacted, the current program, until some consensus can be reached in Congress among those who support one solution over another. There's a gas tax scenario, in which case we would have a solution based both on indexing and a direct increase on the level of taxation on gasoline, and that would provide some temporary relief, but ultimately, given everything else we know about fuel efficiency and about the cost of maintaining and improving surface transportation, it's unlikely to be a sustainable solution. There's an innovation scenario in which case the Congress and the Secretary of Transportation look to states like Texas, who have been doing new and innovative things to try and finance faster, better transportation, the bonds, the tolls, PPPs, that sort of thing. It is not the most likely result given the current positions of the leadership in the committees in Congress. Or there's the undecided scenario, which is a mishmash of some tax increases for temporary relief, some relief in terms of innovative financial tools, some additional flexibility for states, but that at least in its best context would provide no strong direction for which way the financing of highways will take in the future. At this moment, I would predict that that's the most likely outcome, but the good news is they're going to vote at this moment. And I think that leadership can change the direction that those scenarios are going to take. And those of you who work with TxDOT regularly know that leadership is not something they're shy about. I think they're going to be looking both to what the commission recommends, what the Texas delegation recommends, what is working now in Texas and is likely to provide the kinds of results that we're going to need in the future to try and influence those scenarios in a direction that provides us in Texas with the freedom we need in order to build the highways that the public demands and deserves. Thank you.
Usually I'd make a joke like, thank you, Mr. Sunshine, but but I think I'll just say thank you, Mr. Reality. Very enlightening, and going back to my analogy of the perfect storm, Billy, I think the barometric pressure just got a little lower in that storm coming from the east. I'm honored and privileged to introduce our next speaker, Mr. Jack Shenendorf. Mr. Shenendorf's practice at Covington and Burlington concentrates on transportation and legislation with a particular focus on legislative strategy, legislative procedures, and the federal budget process. He was recently appointed by Speaker Hastert to the National Surface Transportation Policy and Revenue Study Commission, where he serves as the vice chairman. For nearly 25 years, Mr. Shenendorf served on the staff of the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was chief of staff from 1995 to 2001. And in BNA's daily report for executives, Mr. Shenendorf was described as one of the most powerful staffers on the Hill, who has played a large role in crafting every piece of major transportation legislation in the past decade. Prior to joining the firm in 2001, Mr. Shenendorf served on the Bush-Cheney transition, where he was chief of the transition policy team for U.S. Department of Transportation and was responsible for reviewing all transportation policies and issues for the incoming administration. Jack, we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and it's an amazing turnout for Highway Finance at 8:30 in the morning. You're all to be congratulated. Let me get started by giving you a little background. As was mentioned, I'm on the National Surface Transportation Policy and Revenue Study Commission. We have 12 members. The chairperson is Secretary Peters. We have 12 diverse points of view, very involved people on this commission. And as a result, I think we're going, at the end of the day, to get a good work product, because I think the diversity of views will really test the theories that we have, and hopefully we'll be able to reach consensus. It's going to take a lot of work, but I think it's doable. We are looking at all surface transportation modes. So we'll be looking at highways, transit, inner-city freight rail, inner-city passenger rail, and so all of the modes. It's not just highways, not just transit. We'll also be looking at freight rail and passenger rail. We're supposed to be looking at three different perspectives: short-term, medium-term, long-term. We're looking out 50 years as to what the system should look like in 50 years. And our charge is really to look at the whole package. We're looking at the needs. What is it that we need in the way of transportation to meet the needs of the 21st century? What should the roles of government be, and particularly what's the federal role as we move forward? And then how are we going to finance the investments that are needed? We are scheduled to send our report to Congress at the end of December, and I anticipate that we will meet that date. Our status so far is we have completed our hearings. We have a number of analyses going on, scenario runs that are being done by the commission staff. And basically, we've just started our deliberations. We'll be meeting 2 days next week. We have a retreat scheduled for 2 days in early August, another set of meetings 2 days at the end of August. And hopefully we'll start to have a draft report by toward the end of September as we try to proceed to finishing our report by the end of the year. As we get started, one of our witnesses talked about this quote from Yogi: you've got to be very careful if you don't know where you're going, because you might not get there. And sometimes this process has kind of felt like that. And it reminded me of another story that's told about Yogi Berra, and it's told by Jim Bunning, who's from Kentucky, all-star pitcher. He swears this is a true story. He's in the Hall of Fame and pitched in both the American League and the National League. And he was pitching at Yankee Stadium one day, and he was just getting bombed. I mean, the Yankees were hitting him every, I think they'd scored like 6 or 7 runs in the first 2 innings. And finally he realized that the Yankee first base coach, who was Bob Turley, another famous pitcher, was stealing his signs. And every time that he was going to throw a fastball, Turley would whistle to alert the Yankee batters. And if he didn't whistle, then they knew he was going to throw a curve or off-speed pitch. And so the batters were just sitting on him. The Yankees were just sitting and waiting for the pitchers, basically knowing what they were going to be. And so when he figured this out, he walked over to Turley, and he said to him, if you whistle again, I realize what you're doing, I'm going to hit the batter. And so he goes back to the mound. Mickey Mantle steps in, another Yankee great. And Bunning looks in, calls for a fastball. Turley whistles, and Bunning hits Mantle in the back. And Mantle falls down. He's in obvious pain. He hobbles down to first base. And in steps Yogi Berra. And he gets in the batter's box. He looks out, and he looks down at first and sees Mantle is still in pain. He puts his hand up and calls time, and he walks out about 2 or 3 steps and says, "Hey, Bunning, if Turley's whistling, I ain't listening." And during these hearings, we have tried to listen to what people are saying. we've had a lot of hearings around the country and heard a lot of important things, and we've tried to make sure that we do listen to what's been said. And one message that has come across loud and clear, and I think if you went amongst the commissioners, there would be no disagreement that we have a national transportation crisis of the first order. Whether you want to call it a perfect storm, I like to think of it sometimes as a slow-motion Katrina, but however you like to think about it, it is a very, very significant problem. And it's made up of three components. There's a crisis in system performance, there's a crisis in funding, and there's a crisis in policy. And with respect to system performance, there are really two aspects of that, as you well know. First is we have an aging system that's at capacity. We are facing an absolutely enormous price tag, way above what's currently being spent in federal, state, and local dollars, just to maintain the existing system that we have. The two examples I like to use to give you some feel for the magnitude of the problem is Woodrow Wilson Bridge, key bridge on the I-95 corridor across the Potomac River on the Washington Beltway. That bridge cost $14 million to build. In today's dollars, it would be $93 million. The cost of the replacement bridge was $2.4 billion. The Springfield Interchange in Northern Virginia, $10 million to build. The reconstruction, almost $800 million. That's the kind of price tags that we are facing around the country for major infrastructure projects as they're nearing their design life and are going to need to be rehabilitated, reconstructed, in many cases redesigned. And so that's part one of the system performance crisis, is this aging infrastructure that's going to need to be rehabilitated and reconstructed. The second piece is that the system is currently saturated in many areas. We all experience that in high congestion, but that is nothing compared to what's coming. The commission forecasts are for 100 million more people over the next 30 to 50 years, basically a quadrupling of the economy and an enormous increase in freight movement as a result of that in this period, and we don't have the additional capacity to handle that. If something dramatic isn't done with respect to our surface transportation systems, we are going to be in gridlock. And of course, with that comes the loss of competitiveness. One of the great blessings of our parents and grandparents back in the 50s when they gave us the interstate system was they gave us this excess capacity in that system, which really helped drive our economy and keep our transportation costs down and make the United States one of the most competitive countries in the world. We are losing that competitive edge. Transportation costs are starting to go up. It is only going to get worse as the system performance really starts to kick in over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And so we have a real problem. Governor Perry talks about that. So I don't think there's any dispute about the problem. There's also a crisis in funding. And again, that really has two components to it. The first is we are not investing enough as a nation. I mean, we are falling short of what's needed just to keep the system where it is today, and constantly it's been deteriorating slowly over time. We don't have anywhere near the resources today at the federal, state, or local level to basically increase the spending sufficiently to rehabilitate the system, much less provide the additional capacity that's needed. So that's the first problem. The second funding problem relates to the fact that the gas tax, which has served transportation so well, has not served transportation well in recent years. The projections are it will level off as more fuel-efficient vehicles come online, alternative fuels come online, so there's going to be an erosion in the purchasing power of the fuel tax. Inflation has already eaten away at it. It's very difficult to increase politically, as you all know. So consequently, since it was last increased, we've seen a significant erosion in its purchasing power. And so consequently, the gas tax, at least currently, is not getting the job done. And there's also a crisis in transportation policy, the third piece of this. And at the federal level, what that really translates into is a number of things, one of which is the federal program has really lost its focus. Ever since Senator Moynihan declared that the era of the interstate was over in the 1991 ICE-T bill, there really has not been a federal mission or a federal purpose. If somebody asked you in 1975 what the purpose of the program is, everybody would think we're building the interstate system together as a nation. If you ask people, what are we doing today, I can't tell you, and this is where I spend my livelihood. This is my livelihood. I mean, we're basically giving money back to the states in what has almost become a transportation revenue sharing program. And so the program really has lost its focus. As a result of that, as the program, as ICE-T was passed and as it's lost its focus over time, since it doesn't have a federal mission, it doesn't have something where everybody says this is in the national interest to do this, what you have seen is everybody says, well, if there's no, subconsciously maybe, if there's no national interest, then I ought to get back everything I can myself. And so you've seen rise of the donor-donee fight, every state looking at the money and saying, I ought to get back 100% of what I send up to Washington, because they don't see the overriding federal vision that would justify a disparity in who gets what because you're building a national system the way we built the interstate. You also see members of Congress now, instead of being able to go home and pointing to something important like the interstate system that's being built, they're going to bring projects home. So you've seen this rise in earmarks since 1991 because that's their way of going home and telling people what this transportation bill was about, because otherwise they've had difficulty in figuring out what the federal purpose is. So that's a part one of the policy crisis, I think, is the loss of federal vision, of federal mission. Part two of the policy crisis is the delivery system. I mean, the delivery system in the federal program is clearly broken. It takes far too long to get projects done, too much red tape, too many hoops to jump through. As a result, you find a lot of states that take the federal money and put it on the least controversial projects because that way they know they can get it spent and actually try to find state money or other money to build some of the bigger and more controversial projects. Many of the areas that we went to, we heard this from witnesses at the state and local level. So as we move forward, that's going to be something I think that does need to be fixed. The national implications of this transportation crisis are enormous to our country. Transportation is, and you all know this as professionals in this area, transportation is absolutely essential to our economy. And whether or not you believe we ought to be spending more on national defense or more on welfare programs or more on food stamps or more on education, none of that can happen without a strong economy. And we won't have the economy that will generate the revenue to do all of the nice things that people want to do unless we have a strong transportation system. And not only a strong transportation system, but the best transportation system in the world. That's what served us up to this point, and that's what we need going forward. And we can't compete with the Chinas, the Indias of the world if we don't have that kind of a transportation system as we move forward. In addition, you've got the American way of life. I mean, people want mobility. With 100 million more people coming, most of whom will be in our cities, you're not going to be able to move around those cities unless we invest more in the various modes of transportation to ensure that people have the mobility they need. So this is enormously important that we solve this problem. The other thing that we heard from virtually every witness, and this may come as a surprise to you, is virtually every witness, not every, I mean, I'd say 85 to 90% of the witnesses that we had basically pleaded for a federal leadership, the definition of a federal vision or a federal mission as to what we're trying to accomplish, and said that we need more money from the federal government to help solve these problems. We just had at our last meeting, the group of seven public sector groups came in, the Governors Association, state legislators, counties, cities. They all said the same thing and echoed it. Every single one of them, when pushed on it, said, no, we need a bigger and stronger federal role as we go forward into the future if we're going to solve the problem that of the magnitude that we actually have. Consequently, and one other thing is that as we solve these problems, as we deal with the transportation, the Commission is also aware that we have these other national priorities to reduce dependence on foreign oil and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So our recommendations are going to have to also fit within that context. I mean, we just, you know, have got to be sensitive to this, and hopefully our recommendations will align with these other national priorities that we have. I think the biggest challenge that we're going to have as a country, both at the federal level and state and local, is that if you can't solve the problems that we have without investing large sums of money. I don't care whether you're talking about federal money, whether you're talking about private money coming in, whether you're talking about state money. It costs money to make the transportation improvements that we need. And if we are going to ask the American people to pay, then we really need to reestablish the covenant that we had with them, similar to what we had during the interstate system, where the government went out and said, here's what we're going to build, here's the way we're going to raise the money, and we're going to use the money for its intended purpose, and we're going to get the job done, and the country delivered and built the interstate system, which is the best surface transportation system in the world, best highway system in the world currently. And so we're going to need to tell them what they're going to get for their investment, and then we need to deliver at whatever level of government is raising the funds. And that's why the vision is so important. That's why being able to define what it is that the program's intended to do, be it the federal program or the state program, the local program, is extraordinarily important, because that's really what you're taking to people and saying, this is what we want to build, this is what it's going to cost, and, oh, by the way, here's how we're raising the money for it. But people are willing to accept the raising of the money if they understand what they're going to get for it and if they believe you're going to deliver. I think if we try to just go out and say we need more money and try and raise it that way, people are going to rebel. Now let's turn to the financing itself in a little bit more detail. And one of the things that we're obviously looking at and focusing a great degree on is the federal program and basically how whatever is going to be done in the future at the federal level, what that should be, and then how it's going to fit in to whatever the rules are for state and local government. And basically, we'll be looking at the adequacy of the various revenue sources, what do they yield, are they responsive to inflation, stability. We'll be looking at the equity and fairness of the methods. How do they reallocate costs among users? What's the perception of them? The efficiency of them, will they result in better decision-making, economic growth, simplicity, how hard or easier it is to administer it, how easy is it to evade these taxes? So there are a lot of different criteria, the public understanding and support for them, and the user charge rationale, which is often used in transportation, about the users paying for the system. So there's a lot of different criteria that we'll be looking at in order to try to determine how to go about this. So let's start with fuel taxes, which has been the kind of the history of how the program has formed. And basically, looking at it at the federal level, the federal government, the federal aid program, only about 20% of the nation's roads are eligible for federal funding. And those 20% of the nation's roads carry almost 80% of the vehicle miles traveled in the United States. These are the highest use roads in the United States. This is the federal aid system. The interstate system is at the apex of that. It's the highest level federal system, followed by the national highway system, of which the interstate is part, and other major arterials throughout the country. But this is the system that the federal gas tax dollars has helped to develop over time. And the theory is that this is a network, and that all drivers benefit from that network. The fact that you can get on the federal aid system and travel anywhere throughout the United States, you can travel coast to coast without going through a red light, that having that network there benefits everyone. And even if you yourself aren't personally driving through Iowa, there are trucks that are delivering goods to you, to your family, that are using those roads and are bringing the produce and are bringing the other goods that you buy, and therefore that everybody has an interest in this national network and supporting the national network. And that's why when you pay your federal gas tax at the pump, that is basically what that money is used for, and therefore the users are paying for this federal system of roads that carry most of the traffic throughout the United States. If you look at the interstate system, which would be good for us to focus on a little bit, this is the system that the gas tax built. There was a very clear vision as to what it should be, how it should be done. The trust fund was set up, and the system was funded on a cost-to-complete basis, so that as states would estimate their costs, that's the percentage of the funding they would get, their percentage of the cost versus the national percentage of the cost. And whatever that percentage happened to be, that's what they would get the following years, and eventually the system got built. So it was a very, very effective tool. So the interstate system and the gas taxes are an example of how the fuel tax can be used in a very efficient way to construct a major system on a national scale and have it work. Now, the gas tax in recent years, we hear people saying, you heard Governor Perry say it last night if you were at dinner, is it's antiquated, it's not going to get the job done anymore. And when people ask, well, why is that? The answer usually comes back, it's politically very difficult to raise the gas tax. It just isn't going to happen. The legislatures aren't going to approve an increase in the gas tax. And so there's this perception and maybe reality out there that the gas tax is just something that isn't going to be an effective way to fund transportation in the future. The other aspect of the gas tax is that it's I think people have felt that the gas tax just represents an old way of doing things, that it isn't a new way of doing things, and people are looking for a new way rather than old ways. And so the gas tax has been pretty much in disfavor now. It's very difficult to raise it politically. I would argue, though, that part of the reason that it's difficult to raise is people really don't understand what you're raising it for. And if you went and asked, should there be an increase in the federal gasoline tax, most people probably say no, because they don't know what, and they don't really trust what it would be used for. They think of the bridge to nowhere. But the question is, if you really had a defined mission, then would there be the political support to raise the gas tax if people really understood and bought into what you were going to do with the money? And ultimately, over a long period of time, the gas tax will probably have to be replaced, because the motor fuel tax simply will probably be dealing with alternative fuels, and there's a lot of interest in the vehicle mile travel tax. And so in the long term, something will have to be done with the gas tax anyway. And so there's this whole perception out there that it really is not the way to go. So what are people recommending? Let me just step back one second and explain another aspect of the federal program. Looking at it from a federal perspective, there's a great interest in the interstate transportation and the movement of people and goods in interstate commerce. If you look at the national rail system, the federal government prohibits state and local governments from taxing rail freight and railroads directly. The state or locality couldn't go in and set up a toll at a rail highway crossing and say to the train, you're going to have to pay this toll because we want to do a grade separation, because the federal government has prohibited them from doing that. The same with airline passengers. Because the federal government wants people to be able to move in air commerce, states and localities are prohibited from taxing passengers. And in recent years, that has been relaxed through the PFC, but there it's very tightly regulated and money can only be used on the airport facility for certain kinds of airport improvements. The same thing applies in transportation. In the national system, the federal aid system, states and localities are prohibited from imposing tolls, in part because it was felt it was kind of double taxation, we're paying for these roads with the gas tax, but also in part in recognition of the fact that this is interstate commerce and to allow states and localities to go in there and just start throwing up toll booths anywhere along the way would be a problem for interstate commerce. And so one of the alternatives to the fuel tax, people say, is what we ought to toll. Well, what that would mean, essentially, is that the federal government would have to change the law to allow state and local governments to come in and toll. And that is one of the real options that are out there. Tolling is a pretty pure user fee in many respects. I mean, they're the people that are using a facility, especially if it's a new facility that's being built with bond proceeds, that if the toll facility is basically being funded through this mechanism, then I think there's a basic fairness to it, and it is a good user fee. But let me pose some ideas. What about situations where the tolls are going to be set high enough to fund not only the facility, but also other transportation projects throughout the state? Like Indiana. Is it fair to ask the people who are driving on the Indiana Turnpike to not only pay the toll and the user fee for the turnpike and for the improvements to the turnpike, but also for projects hundreds of miles away that they'll never use, may never use? How should that fit into all this? What's that burden on interstate commerce? What about where people want to use toll money for non-transportation purposes? Look at the Chicago Skyway. Some of those proceeds were used for home heating oil subsidies to retire the debt in the city of Chicago. That's not a user fee at that point. That becomes a tax. When you raise the tolls on the turnpike to a level that's higher than is needed to operate and construct the turnpike itself for other purposes, then that's no longer a user fee. That turns into to a tax. And so this whole issue of tolling, part of the issue is what are the proceeds going to be used for? It is a very, very pure and arguably a very fair user fee when you're talking about the facility itself, especially new facilities, but it gets a little murkier as to what the situation is when the money is used for other transportation projects that are not in the corridor, that are maybe hundreds of miles away, or when it's used for non-transportation purposes. Pricing is another example which takes a step beyond tolling and encompasses things like congestion pricing, variable pricing, all road pricing, where every road would be priced when you went out. And again, some of the concerns here are that at certain levels, I mean, we could price the system so that we didn't need any excess capacity. We didn't need any additional capacity, because you could make it so expensive that people couldn't drive, trucks couldn't move, but that's going to be hurting the economy. It's going to be hurting people's mobility. So where do you find that balance between using pricing to help meet demand and, by the same token, not going so far that you really impede economic growth and personal mobility? You have the same issue of using the money, the funds that are generated. Are you going to use the funds on that facility or in that corridor? Or are you going to use it for non-transportation purposes? The state of New Jersey was talking about setting up a system where they would privatize and use the monetization for paying off their pension plans. And so the people in the New Jersey Turnpike for years and years and years would be paying charges for these pension plans. And so those kinds of issues, I think, have to be sorted through when talking about pricing, when talking about tolling. There are a number of issues. There are very legitimate ways to use those tools. But I think there are some other situations where they can be misused to the detriment of our national economy and our personal mobility. Which brings me to public-private partnerships. I think at the outset that clearly the private sector has a role in helping to solve our transportation problems. I don't think there's any question about that. The private sector also appears willing to come in and help with the financing of it and provide significant amounts of financing. And again, I think that's a very good thing. The question is how to do it in a way that aligns with the public interest. And that's where I think it gets quite complicated, in doing these things in a way that is consistent with the public interest. There has been a lot of privatization where there's been monetizing of assets in the water and wastewater area, in solid waste, in toll roads, as startups. So there are a lot of examples of privatization. But there are very, very few examples where you have a pure monetization of assets in the fashion of the Chicago Skyway and the Indiana Toll Road. And usually government does it to reduce costs, to stabilize costs, not to increase them. And these facilities were done with the express purpose of being able to increase the revenues. And most of the time in the past, these things are like in a 5 to 30 year window, as opposed to a 75 year and 99 year windows of those projects. And let me just give you an example of what some people see as a wonderful thing and an example of what should be done, what others see as a problem of privatization, certain types of privatization. In the Chicago Skyway, the initial rate increases of 12.5% per year for a total of 150% in 12 years, and then ongoing increases of 2% to 7% or more over the life of the facility, which is 99 years. Now, if it's so hard to raise money and to get people to support it, how did they ever do this? Why would they do this? This is raising an enormous amount of money from people. Well, one reason may have been that the people who are going to be paying this are Indiana commuters and not the voters of Chicago. And so that when you get down and you have localities imposing these things, then a lot of times the people who are paying are not the constituents that are holding, the voters that are holding the politicians accountable, and they'll enter into these kinds of deals. In Indiana, you had a very similar situation. When they were being questioned at one of our commission meetings, the answer came back, well, we didn't really care because 60% of the people that use it are out of state. And so, but from a federal perspective, it's an issue because those out-of-state people, the out-of-state people that are carrying freight and the people like you and I that are trying to drive on vacations. The Chicago Skyway allows for increases of 2% CPI or GDP, and GDP is really the higher of them all. It has averaged 4.3 to 7.4% annually over the last number of years. And also allows higher tolls for vehicles of three axles or more. And for this, they got an upfront payment of $1.8 billion. Well, and these toll facilities are two primary drivers of revenue. One is the rate, and the other is the amount of traffic that you get. At the floor toll rate of the 2% increases, The net present value of the increased revenue from tolls alone exceeds $1.4 billion, or 78% of the equity that was put up. And at 3%, the full franchise fee will be recovered from toll increases alone, so that all the growth in revenue due to increased traffic will basically go to the private company. That money will be lost to the states of the city of Chicago and to Indiana for transportation purposes. And so that's one of the concerns, that in some of these deals, not all of these deals, some of the deals are very good deals, but in some of these deals, they have basically given away a revenue stream that could have been used for transportation and given it away for 99 years or 75 years. And that's going to be a loss for transportation. In addition, the people who use those facilities are going to be paying those high rates. And they're basically going into corporate profits and shareholders, and in many cases, not even people in the United States, that they're going overseas with this money. So how these deals are structured are enormously important from an overall transportation perspective and for trying to build a national system. So if people are willing to pay these kinds of tolls, then one question would be, why not try to capture that for the public good and make sure that the company, if you're going to do it through privatization, gets a fair rate of return? But the rate of return on the Chicago Skyway was predicted anywhere from 8% to almost 18%. That's a very high rate of return, and all of that rate of return could have been used for transportation if it had been financed differently or if there had been some sort of cap on the rate of return, then it would have been possible to recapture some of that for the transportation facilities elsewhere in the state. So with that, these are the things that we are looking at, grappling with. I think my own personal view is that the real solution to this is all of the above, but all of the above in a way that produces a quantum increase in investment, because that's what's going to be needed to solve our transportation problem. If we just do these bills where you get a little bit more funding, a little bit more funding, this country is going to become a second-rate economic power in the not-too-distant future. And the only way to avoid that is really with a new mission, hopefully that is a good partnership, federal, state, local, private, utilizing all of these tools in a way that's fair for everyone, that has the support of the American people. And if we can do that, then I think we'll be able to solve these problems. But it's going to take a major effort, and there is no one magic bullet to this. And my final slide is, my boss used to tell me when things would get dark, especially during T21, when we were trying to take the trust funds off budget and get guaranteed funding, which we were eventually successful in. So when all else fails, do the right thing. And I think that's what all of the commissioners are trying to do. We're trying to do the right thing, not just take assumptions, oh, it's politically too hard to raise the gas tax, and therefore it's not going to happen. I would just point out and close with something that I find very amusing. People talk about the gas tax is politically difficult to raise. Well, the pricing assumptions that DOT used in some of the models that went into the CMP needs report was an average of 20 cents per mile on congested. This is average throughout the country, a 20 cents per mile on congested roads. Well, if you've got a car that gets 25 miles to the gallon, that's a $5 equivalent to a $5 increase in the gasoline tax on driving on a congested road, on just the average. And there are some areas, many areas, where it's a lot higher than that because you need to have it a lot higher to get people to not drive during that time frame. So the American people aren't stupid. They understand, they will understand this when it hits their pocketbook. And all of these solutions are going to take a lot of political will, a lot of leadership from our political leaders. Governor Perry certainly is doing that here in Texas. and hopefully all working at a team at the federal, state, and local level to get this job done, because we have to educate the people as to the importance of this problem, and then we have to earn their support so that we can really put together a full package of solutions, because it's going to take a full package of solutions to generate the investment that's needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. You know, you mentioned the billions it's going to take to bring our infrastructure back. I was looking at the USA Today, and you know, after that steam pipe ruptured in New York City, the tragedy and everything like that, now they're looking at it as what's needed. And I think that they were using some numbers that the American Society of Civil Engineers says that to fix our aging infrastructure we have out there is going to cost $1.6 trillion over the next 5 years. And that's water, road, bridges, and everything like that. That's a tremendous amount, and you mentioned it's in the billions, and we have to get people focused on this. And we're running a little long. I want to thank our panelists, Billy, Mitch, and Jack, for a great presentation today. And if you would, join me in thanking them again, especially for traveling for a long way.